If you'd like then to turn to the passage that we had read to us a moment ago. And the title of what I'm going to be speaking on this evening is this: Grace in Affliction. Grace in Affliction. And we're looking at the experience of the great apostle Paul, his thorn in the flesh, and seeing the truth of those words. We see in verse 9 that the Lord spoke to him, that my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. So that's the subject before us this evening. And I admit freely that what prompted me to think along these lines was the particular health situation that I had been experiencing, well, in truth, for the last 12 years or so. I know some of you dear friends here were kind enough to pray for me that the Lord might deliver me. And it still amazes me that I am fit enough and well enough to be able to stand here and minister from the Word of God again. So we're going to do some exegesis, first of all, of this passage, understand something of the different words, the language that Paul uses. What is the background happening there around and about him as best we can understand it? And then to see the reality of that grace, that sufficient grace, and something, just something, of its variety. So my first heading is this: thorn in the flesh. Thorn in the flesh. So what was the situation that Paul had encountered and which, in truth, he was keen to be rid of? The trouble had obviously been severe. Paul tells us, concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. He tells us this in verse 8. And we notice that. 3 times. Thrice. So this was not something that he was enduring that was light and superficial. It was a serious problem that the apostle was experiencing. But what is the thing that he is referring to there? He describes it, doesn't he, to us as a thorn in the flesh and also as a messenger of Satan. You see that also there in verse 7. 2 descriptions then, which conveys something of the sense of what it felt like to the apostle, without actually saying precisely what it was. There is a simile, like a thorn in the flesh. In other words, it was something like this, a likeness that he is establishing, using an everyday situation to convey something of this felt reality. If you prune your rose bushes at home there, if you have rose bushes to prune, you'll soon know the meaning of having a thorn in the flesh from that. And then there is the messenger of Satan, the messenger of Satan. But again, the identity of this messenger is not spelt out to us here. He refers to the cause of his trouble, again, obliquely in verse 8. But simply with the Greek word, this. This, to which the translators have added thing. This thing. Paul does not elaborate more. Because the fact is that the main point of this particular section of his second letter to the Corinthians does not actually hinge on the precise identity of his thorn in the flesh, or messenger of Satan. We have, as always, to be honest to the context. Paul is writing about this incident for a particular reason. It is not central to his purpose to identify what this thing was that was causing him difficulty. More important for his purpose is countering the version of divine approval and authentication being circulated by various false apostles who are busy undermining Paul in Corinth and burnishing their own credentials as credible, gifted, and spiritual leaders. These men were claiming divine authority and power, and were grounding their appeal in great accomplishments and revelations that they had received. And that all has a very, very contemporary feel about it. And we could name the names of such people who present themselves and claim great power and great authority. And Paul makes a comment on their habit of self-promotion. Were we to have looked in 2 Corinthians and in chapter 10, verses 12 to 13 and verses 17 to 18, he says this: "For we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. But he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. For not he that commendeth himself is approved, but whom the Lord commendeth." Unlike the false apostles who boasted about the things that made them look very impressive, Paul instead boasts, and we put that word in inverted commas, about the things that make him look very unimpressive. All the beatings, the shipwrecks, the dangers, the deprivations. And he rounds off the list of trials that we read earlier there in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. "If I must needs glory, I will glory of the things which concern mine infirmities." Chapter 11 and verse 30. The thorn in the flesh incident becomes a further piece of supporting evidence that the Lord does not back boastful, got it all together, supremely cool and successful individuals. The Lord works through weakness, through weakened people in their struggles and in their trials. The Lord keeps his servants in check and humbles them. He sends them frowning providences, thorns in the flesh, not celebration bouquets of roses. His strength is made perfect in weakness, as described to us there in verse 9. God's method is to communicate his gospel, his character, his ways through hindered, battling, greatly exercised individuals. The precise identity then of the thorn in the flesh or messenger of Satan is not strictly relevant to his purpose. Reviewing the whole section, including the thorn in the flesh, Paul concludes, verses 9 and 10, "Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. When I am weak, then am I strong." So in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, there is no person that is named, nor group of people, nor a specific condition. But if Paul is not giving us a precise identity, the effect of the thorn is, however, fairly obvious. It rendered the great apostle, in some sense, weak. That is how it affected him. The word, asthenia, refers to being strengthless or suffering some infirmity. And that is perhaps a clue, maybe, to the nature of the affliction. For we are in good company if we reckon it was a physical impairment rather than something by way, for example, of overt persecution by someone. It looks more likely Paul is referring obliquely to a physical complaint or malady that was impairing his ability to do the work that the Lord had called him to do. Paul, remember, is the man who said in a previous communication to the church in Corinth these things, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 16, "For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. That is what the gospel work meant to him. From this, it's very easy to understand why Paul prayed with such urgency for deliverance from this weakening and hindering condition. So retracing our steps a little, from what we are seeing here, can we get a little nearer to specifying what the precise nature of this hindrance might have been? Well, we can only in one sense speculate, but many think that it runs like this. Paul, you may recall, had referred to an illness that had caused him to remain among the churches in Galatia. So we find him saying in Galatians chapter 4, and verses 13 and 14 this. You know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first. And my temptation, which was in my flesh, ye despised not, nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. It is possible that in this passage, in Galatians chapter 4, we're hearing Paul describe the infirmity that he is now speaking of in 2 Corinthians in chapter 12. So going back to Galatians 4, there in verse 15, he continues in this wise. What is then the blessedness ye spake of? For I bear you record that if it had been possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and have given them to me. His reference to their giving him their own eyes, if they could, gives us a strong hint that it might have been some eye condition that had stopped Paul travelling on and had detained him in Galatia. So from this, though admittedly it is no more than informed speculation, we have some basis for supposing the eye condition might have flared up again and halted Paul in his tracks, on this occasion maybe preventing him from being able to minister at all. The weakening effect produced by the thorn in the flesh that Paul refers to in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, fits in rather well with the effect of a physical infirmity, along the lines perhaps of this eye condition that detained him in Galatia. But now my next heading, putting the record straight, because it's only fair to point out that other commentators have come to an alternative opinion and are drawn by the idea of the messenger of Satan, and therefore reckon the hindrance to Paul was an actual person. By way of further exegesis, were one to turn to the Old Testament and look at some of the warnings there for disobedience, obstructive people were often described as thorns. For example, Moses in Numbers chapter 33 and verse 55 warns the people in this manner. But he said, if ye will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell. The warning is clear. Future disobedience on the part of the Lord's people will mean hindrances and obstructions set in their way, spoiling their peaceful enjoyment of the land that the Lord was giving to them. The Lord warned his people, their troubles would come from the pagan people whom they had failed to dislodge. Other people then would become the thorns in their side. And we could turn in Joshua chapter 23 verses 11 to 13 and to Judges chapter 2 and verses 2 to 3 to see that thought continued there. But these Old Testament impediments and restrictions were designed to punish the people for their disobedience. And that's not the precise situation that Paul was in. He was not being punished for disobedience, because he explains why the trouble has come his way. It was there explained in verse 7 of 2 Corinthians chapter 12. He says this, lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. So the Old Testament references, referring to people that the Lord might use to punish disobedience, however strong we might feel the pull to identify thorns in the flesh with people, as in Numbers chapter 33 and elsewhere, I think we would in this instance be wise to partially uncouple the idea of the thorn in the flesh from its immediate Old Testament context. In other words, we uncouple it from the reference to the cause, namely disobedience, and retain instead and major on its linkage to the effect in the Old Testament and the effect for Paul, which was the loss of comfort and of peace. That way, we honour both the Old Testament context and the explicit explanation Paul provides in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 for his thorn in the flesh. But before we leave this, just another word to briefly look at, which is deeply suggestive. And it's the word in verse 7 rendered buffet. That comes from the Greek word, kolophizo, and implies being struck by a clenched fist. It is a blow to the body or to the head that has the effects of somewhat concentrating the mind and completely distracting you from the task at hand. We can imagine Paul facing some illness that is overwhelming, that simply cannot be ignored, and which puts everything out of joint, all plans, all the work that he had hoped to achieve. So what then are some of the lessons we can learn, that piece of exegesis done? So now my next heading. Ups and downs. Ups and downs. Now one key distinction that we could make to identify those situations that we might encounter as Christians, and those that we might also understand somewhat differently simply because we are part and parcel of the human race. There is a distinction, perhaps, that we can make there. There are lots of afflictions, incidents, or conditions that believers and non-believers alike face. The sun shines and the rain falls on both camps. And so anything that comes by way of the weather is indiscriminate. Christians' homes, and I see also here churches, can get flooded, and those belonging to non-Christians and Christians fare likewise. High winds topple down trees on the properties of blasphemers and lovers of God. Droughts wreck the harvests of the godly and the ungodly. Or take machinery and equipment. Computers crash, trains are delayed, flights are cancelled, appointments are missed due to malfunctioning cars, and this is so for all humanity. Christians are not especially singled out for bad or good treatment in many regards. And what then of our health? Well, indeed, sicknesses come in equal measure to Christians and non-Christians alike. Sicknesses can be very indiscriminate. They affect the bodies and minds of Christians and non-Christians. And the same goes for various conditions. Chronic conditions, untreatable conditions. These are the lot of all humanity. And the same goes for accidents. Christians can sometimes think that only they have these kinds of things happen to them. But a trip to the local hospital or the doctor's surgery should dispel that notion. Paul called his thorn in the flesh a messenger of Satan. And the devil does try to employ our more everyday trials to put negative thoughts in our minds, such as to make us doubt even our spiritual state. Grace is especially given to us to counter those suggestions. For church history tells us that some of the choicest saints have endured painful conditions that are the lot of all mankind. The great C.H. Spurgeon springs to mind in that category. But what are we to think about those situations, the ones that we share with non-Christians, which are the lot of humanity? How do we deal with them? Do we panic or grumble or emit some unbelieving nonsense about this would happen to me? Do we cope better or worse than the world does in dealing with these issues? After all, it is the same for everyone else. And herein is the challenge. How do we, as people who have the Lord for us and with us, come through these more everyday matters? Do we present something different to the unbelieving world in how we deal with these afflictions and difficulties? Or are we worse than unbelievers, more bad-tempered, more angry and complaining, more ready to argue and find someone or something to blame? Do we meet adverse circumstances with faith and hope and courage? Ideally, non-Christians should be able to detect something special because we have a well-grounded hope of eternal life. We have God for us and promising to be with us at every point. We will have his help wherever we turn. And knowing that should show in how we live our lives in this fallen world, where accidents will happen, calamities will befall us or those we love, and where death is still, barring the imminent return of Christ, going to be something each of us in turn is going to have to face. The promise to Paul was, "My grace is sufficient for thee." And we are to believe this. And, really, the thought is to master us precisely when things are going awry. Sometimes, yes, it can be very evident why the Lord is bringing a particular trouble upon us. The Lord might bring a challenge in an area of known weakness and difficulty. We might have had a comfortable ride, and it's time to toughen up or toughen up some more. Trials and afflictions may have some striking and some very personal aspect to them, something that takes us maybe back to a point in our lives where we failed previously and where now we are invited to seek the Lord's help and improve on our past performance. The variety of lessons and the grace that accompanies these is endless. So now my next heading, Christian troubles, Christian troubles. There are also hardships and troubles that are the especial lot of Christians. Here we may think persecution or trial is the word that springs more readily to mind than maybe affliction. Man-made troubles, devil-inspired trials, things like persecution, where Christians are the object of attack, discrimination, ridicule, legal action, false accusation. These may arise because of the gracious and standout behavior that Christians show. Our conduct should and often does attract attention because it is different to the unbeliever. People often may be very happy to have trustworthy, reliable, honest, hardworking people as part of their organization, workplace, or school. Employers do not usually grumble if their employees turn up on time, work hard, do not steal from the company, and are obliging and friendly. Teachers do not normally grumble if children are well-behaved and conscientious. But those with less of a stake in the success of the organization or institution may not see it the same way. Those on the shop floor or in the classroom or at the desk next door may not be so impressed. Our behavior might be a standing rebuke to them. Their attitudes may be slovenly and lacklustre in how they go about their work. They may be stealing from the company, fiddling their expenses, exaggerating their output, or engaged in some morally dubious operation. The last thing they want is their sin being reproved by someone with standards totally out of sympathy with their own. So, for these and many other reasons, we as Christians may be open to being attacked verbally, physically, emotionally, and in a host of other ways. And that is before we've even opened our mouths. So then there's the persecution and affliction which follows as a result of our spoken testimony. Perhaps we explained to somebody the way of the gospel, or gave a tract or Bible to do the talking for us. We might have given somebody a booklet explaining six-day creation, or given a calm, reasoned defense of traditional marriage. Open-air preaching and Christians operating their businesses according to their Christian moral convictions have all had difficulties thrust upon them in recent years. This is trouble that is confined to being a Christian. These troubles, trials and afflictions, which come in various packages, these are the kind that come to us particularly and distinctly because we're believers. And in a way, we can understand those kinds of afflictions and trials better, maybe. They come as a reaction there of the sinful world against us, a sinful world that is under the sway of the evil one. Peter remarks about the lust, lewdness, drunkenness that was part of the Christian's pre-conversion life. And then he comments on the reaction of the world. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4. He says this, "Wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you." That's what they do. They speak evil of us. They see something different, they hear something different. And there, from the word of God, we can see this is all to be expected, and in many ways this is easier to accept than some other frowning providences which may assail us. So if you're the person suffering loss and hardship, stress or pain because you are a Christian, be encouraged. There is grace, sufficient grace for you. Be the source of trouble, a family member, a neighbor, a work colleague. Your trials are known to the Lord. This is the path, of course, that the Lord himself has already walked. You have the consolation of knowing the Lord's especial provision and mercy. So we might say that they are not unkind or glib words that the Apostle Peter speaks, again in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 12 to 13. When he says this, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice, inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy." So grace is given to us in part here to give us a biblical perspective, so that we can identify ourselves within a passage such as 1 Peter chapter 4. It's given so that we can live out what we read in the Bible. Well, now my next heading, grace in all its variety. Grace in all its variety. When the Lord promised Paul that his grace would be sufficient for him, well, the Lord promised good to his servant. Grace here is to be thought perhaps as the action of God toward his people, especially in regard to work that he will do in the soul of the saint. It covers virtually everything that the Lord might do for us and in us. For one of the things he brings to us is knowledge and understanding. Afflictions, you see, are intended for our good. We're going to always finish ahead, not behind. We have an expectation that this will all lead somewhere, despite the feeling we might have of being delayed or slowed down or hindered. In the end, there is no loss, only gain. And that is what sufficient grace will ensure. So we need to be alert to all the possible ways the Lord might be dealing with us as we endure an affliction or a trial. It's a time for heightened spiritual discernment and sensitivity, and certainly not a time to go absent without leave. That is why it is important to pray during our afflictions and trials. Paul did, thrice, urgently, pleading, and so must we. By prayer, we may well be meaning something less than we would usually be capable of, say, in times of good health and stability. When we're not so well, carefully ordered thoughts or logical progress in our petitions might have to take second place. In my own situation, it was sometimes very hard work to be able to concentrate, knowing that you're about to be suddenly convulsed with an electric shock-like pain at any moment, or indeed to string too many coherent thoughts together when in that phase of pain when it would just pulse without stopping. And many of you, I'm sure, will be familiar of situations like that, either for yourself or those that you love. It can, in truth, be very grueling and very exhausting. But it's important to stay in an attitude of prayer. We remember that even if we may be feeling wretched and unwell, that we are always in the presence of God, even if we're not functioning fully with all our faculties and with a clear mind. He is with us in the pain. And the interior mental world that intense pain sometimes pushes us back into. Because we're not able to cover the range of thought we normally would in our prayers, it does not mean that we're not praying. God reads our hearts better than we do ourselves. Our sighs and groans, our longings, our tears, our utterances, our cries are all registered. If they were not coherent to our way of thinking, Christ's intercession perfects them and makes them more intelligible than we could have made them at the height of the exercise of our powers. For myself personally, it was good at times just to sit and to meditate before the Lord, to have my soul directed to him, even if there were not words capable of being said. It was simply good for me to have been in the Lord's presence. And to have that capacity is a sign, actually, of grace already at work in us. To sigh is a sign of grace in the heart. After all, nobody set limits as to what kind of prayer is admissible or qualifies. Your prayers are a sign of life and of hope and of grace. You're being sustained, you see, from heaven. It may not always look or sound pretty, but your Father knows better. Be encouraged. Remember, he is not shocked by us in our weakened state, nor is he only interested in us when we are on what we might call active service. We've not become a disappointment to him because we're not able to lead the meeting we usually would or do the jobs we normally would have done. I can think of occasions when I was laid out flat on the bed. It was the only place to find any relief. But it was a wonderful truth to ponder as I lay there, rendered out of service, to know that I was loved of God, even if I never preached another sermon or never paid anybody another pastoral visit. Why, if I never rose from that position again, I was still sure of my place in my Father's house above. And that was a good check to the soul, that I really did believe that it was salvation by grace, alone through faith alone. Absolute reliance on Christ's work on the cross is key. These afflictions can bring you to admit the reality of what is known, but sometimes has to be confessed when we're not capable of any tangible works, at least as we might conceive of them. Furthermore, there is grace given to us in such times when we are laid aside in the thought that other people are praying for us. We might be struggling and feel desperately disappointed that speaking, even coherent thinking, are out of the window. But it's immensely comforting, and it was a delight for me personally to think that the Lord would hear the prayers of others on my behalf. So now my next heading, grace in deliverance, grace in deliverance. But then again, perhaps for you, as it was for me, the Lord intends to show some exceptional kindness to encourage you and perhaps to encourage others too. Trials may have a limited time span and then be done with, and we are to move on, greatly encouraged. That is why we are to remain vigilant in our afflictions. We can try to second-guess God and get it wrong. For instance, we know, yes, we deserve nothing but wrath from God given our sin. We know that as saints, we have squandered much light, many opportunities, and spurned many kindnesses of the Lord. It's shaming, isn't it, to think about them. From this, we can only too well imagine that it would be our just deserts to have to stop with the trial and affliction that we are in until our dying day. We are slow to learn and ungrateful and could have no ground to complain if the Lord kept us permanently under the yoke, so unholy and so worldly that we are. Why, yes, we can imagine that we'll always need stern discipline and affliction. And so we can imagine that the Lord is totally justified in maintaining us in this state for time immemorial. But is it not so in keeping with the character of God to be generous to the undeserving and to send grace of deliverance to his people? Perhaps he intends to do that for you. We should not grow so familiar with our afflictions or think that we must remain detained at his majesty's pleasure forever. We need to be ready, if necessary, to change tack, put off our prison clothes like Joseph and prepare for something different and quite unexpected. So whatever our affliction and present difficulty, the Lord may be waiting to show great favor to you. Now my next heading is this: grace to do evangelism. Grace to do evangelism. When we have afflictions or various trials, we should aim always to bring honor to the Lord. And that includes the desire to be a witness. Sometimes, of course, that may be absolutely impossible. We might have been struck unconscious, or be rather embarrassingly non compos mentis. So we may not always be capable of saying anything. There are times, too, when we might not feel like saying anything. We simply do not know what to say. We might have been brought very low, had steep challenges to our faith, be not quite able to trust ourselves to open our mouths. So there are plenty of provisos. But we must not look for too many excuses or ways out. Paul was still serviceable, even under the pressure of his affliction. The promise of sufficient grace was right there, right then. It might not have been the work of gospel ministry that was of the regular kind. No pulpit, perhaps, or public meeting. Instead, there might have been fresh and utterly novel situations to witness that presented themselves to him because of his affliction. And it might be the same for us as well. For example, do not look at doctors and nursing staff, if you have some condition or illness, as a nuisance, or as if they are deliberately there to spoil your day, interfere with you, cause you trouble. You should look to adorn the gospel by how you speak to those people that you might meet doing their work on our behalf. We should seek to move beyond our particular concern or need and think of theirs instead. What sort of a day are they having? What are the pressures the doctors, nursing staff have brought with them as they begin their duty? What's their home life like that they have come away from in order to start their work on the ward? Ask them questions. Show you care about them, that you appreciate them, which I hope we genuinely do. Pray for opportunities to share some gospel truth. Kind people from the caring professions often, when we are needy and vulnerable, ask us questions. Who are we? What do we do? What are our interests? And so we should seek to say something helpful about the Lord, what he means to us, what the direction of our life is. And especially if we're facing death, what then? Perhaps we'll be able, with God's grace, to surprise people with how we deal with that prospect. Does it hold the same terror for us as for some other non-Christian people who might have passed by that way? So we should look to say something about eternity, about where our treasure is. Another heading, grace, the death of pride. Grace, the death of pride. God's promise that he'll be with us in our afflictions also means the death knell for sin. Grace in the midst of suffering helps to promote holiness and bring destruction to its opposite, sin. Paul's affliction was designed to stop him being proud, given the revelations he had received, so that it might be evident instead that the Lord's strength is made perfect in weakness. Something similar may be happening to us as well. John Calvin, for instance, when he comments on 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7, says this, and I'm going to quote him here. Whatever the infirmity is under which we labor, let us bear in mind that we are, as it were, buffeted by the Lord, with the intent of making us ashamed, and in this way, of teaching us humility. Those who are mature in the faith, whose lives display much spiritual fruit, should be especially careful to reflect on this if they are persecuted by those who hate and revile them. These things, not merely rods of the heavenly master, but buffetings intended to humble them and beat down all presumption and pride. End of the quote. It's painful to hear, isn't it? But necessary. We're all given to pride, arrogance, self-sufficiency, stubbornness and vanity. Troubles come to lessen our love for ourselves. We find out what we're made of, and it can be very humbling. Grace is given to be sensitive to the Lord's dealings and to respond with faith and obedience. Repentance is never more in evidence than at such times. That's why Peter is able to say that those who have suffered in the flesh have ceased from sin. Something's been burned out. Some self-love, some self-conceit, some self-reliance dies, or at least it should, if we are alert. God opposes pride in us at every turn. And he is the master at using afflictions and trials to achieve the end of our sanctification. Pride is the loser, and not the only one either, when the Lord deals with us in affliction. Sin's defeat is the victory of holiness and our being made conformed to the image of God's Son. And now my final heading tonight, the grace of believing in eternity. The grace of believing in eternity. It's commonly said that the Lord is always needing to wean us off attachment to this world. And that's so true. Are we too much at home here? Do we expect too much from this fallen world? There are a host of reasons why this flabbiness might set in. Compared to previous generations, here in the West, we are in relatively trouble-free environments. A nation has enjoyed relative peace and prosperity. Amazing medications, procedures that prolong life, reduce pain, and rectify a host of conditions that simply could not be cured in a bygone age. Political parties compete to manage our lives better, cushion us from economic harm, look after our bodies more efficiently, defend us from our nation's enemies, educate us better, and so forth. Government offers to be our protector and our guide, and people expect them to deliver. But as Christians, we know better. We know this is a wicked world, with many wicked people following wicked doctrines for selfish ends. We know that death awaits us all, unless the Lord returns in our lifetime. No government, however well-intentioned, can insulate us completely from all this. But we can begin to buy into the lie, for I fear that that is what it is, that we should enjoy a trouble-free and risk-free life. Job, in the midst of his afflictions, gives one of the most stirring and triumphant accounts of this belief in the life hereafter. Job 19, verses 25 to 27. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another. Though my reins be consumed within me. It is orthodox belief, you see, and practice, to actually place a greater premium on the well-being of our soul when we die than on our well-being here on earth. In other words, we are a heavenly-minded people, and it should show in how we talk about death and this life. Well, we've only begun really to scratch the surface. God's grace is multifaceted. Whatever the afflictions the Lord may send, be encouraged. There will be sufficient grace to come through. If we're in the midst of some shaking or sifting, be attentive, be patient, be humble. The Lord may have some valuable lessons for us, just as he did for Paul with his thorn in the flesh.